Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Leaders in Supply Chain podcast. I am your host, Radu Palamariu, Managing Director of Elkett Global. Today, Susan is joining us. She's the Chief Operations Officer at Bloom Energy. She comes with more than 24 years of manufacturing experience, including automotive vehicles, powertrains, components assembly. She has also worked in executive roles leading manufacturing for Nissan and Ford in her previous life before Bloom. And in addition, she has created and supported organizations that encourage young women to pursue careers in STEM, in what we call STEM, math, science, engineering, as a way to support future generations of technological manufacturing in the United States. So, Susan, great pleasure to have you with us today. And maybe let's start by sharing with us a little bit how you actually ended up in manufacturing. It's not often that we have an executive female that has had such a long-standing career in manufacturing.
Well, first, thank you for hosting me, and I appreciate you being interested in my story and in Bloom. And my career has absolutely been a journey. I started as a lab researcher. My undergraduate degree is in microbiology. I realized that working alone and repeating the same experiment over and over was really not consistent with who I am and really didn't meet my objective of solving big problems. That was the goal I've had for many years. I lost my dad when I was 5 and he was 29 due to a congenital condition. And so I wanted to solve this problem. And that's really what started me on the journey from a technical perspective. And so then I took that technical degree and it's been, you know, lots of weaving that caused me to start my career in manufacturing. And then here I am 24 plus years later, having been in manufacturing for quite some time.
Yes, definitely. It's almost 30 years now. And when you look back, also an interesting point for you was that you've been with this huge automotive giants, you know, Ford, Nissan, but then you stepped into a, well, pretty much a startup type of a world, right? Whilst Bloom is a listed company, but when you joined them 6 years ago, it was still, let's call it, in a startup mode. What made you take this step?
So, you know, I get this question often, particularly, you know, how did you go from microbiology to automotive? How did you go from automotive to Bloom? And how I see this is what I do has been very similar, particularly from automotive to Bloom and energy. It's science, it's physics, it's problem solving, and it's leadership. And, you know, the learning for me and the learning that I like to pass on to others is focus on skills. Skills transfer, and if you master skills, you can transfer between disciplines. So this has allowed me to bring the skills that I learned from working from very large automotive companies into a really dynamic startup, now public, energy company.
Mm-hmm. Understood. And since we are on the topic of Bloom, maybe tell us a little bit and tell our audience a little bit, what does Bloom do more in detail? Because I'm sure that some of them would be curious to know.
Yeah. So I love talking about Bloom. Bloom is an amazing company. And we're the first company to commercialize the technology of solid oxide fuel cells. And we're a clean energy product and we provide distributed power. So we provide essential services for hospitals, data centers, grocery stores, as an example. And to try to describe the product, it's like stacking large refrigerators together, lined up in sequence. And the outcome then is electricity. So we are configurable. You can take these, what we call the Bloom box. We can put them in different configurations. So what I'm most proud of is that we make energy without combustion. And I grew up in a steel town and I'm passionate about air quality and jobs. And the Bloom box provides electricity without combustion. And it's just a great way to take energy to the source of where it's needed. So it's a really interesting product. And I certainly recommend that anyone go to our website. And we have a lot of great information and details on the product.
Mm. And you basically, in terms of Bloom, one is the unique solution, but the other piece that I found quite interesting is the fact that you have decided on the manufacturing side, right? So it's I think the exact name is solid oxide fuel cell power generators. So I hope I said it correctly. But you decided that the manufacturing is based in the U.S. and only in the U.S. So tell us a little bit about that point.
So the majority of our manufacturing is in the U.S. And when I came to Bloom, that manufacturing footprint had already been set. And it's really a very important part of how we do our job. It allows us to have engineering and development teams next to manufacturing. So you get the opportunity to speak commercialization and, most importantly, innovate. We don't have long pipelines of inventory between us and another location. New ideas come up daily in the world that we live in. And this is a evolutionary and a revolutionary product. And it's very common for us to have both R&D and process engineers on the production floor at the same time. So it really is, it's really an integral to the commercialization, but really to the innovation in order to continue to change and develop and bring on new products and go to new markets. Having that synergy and collaboration, I consider absolutely critical for our success and scale.
And I want to coming back a little bit to manufacturing in the US, because obviously there's challenges, and having full, you know, manufacturing supply chain operations comes with that. Obviously there's a higher cost compared to, you know, on the flip side of having everything in one place, there's the higher cost component that comes in basically with the market that, you know, like US. So tell us a little bit maybe about the challenges that you faced when you have this network of supply chain and manufacturing.
So Bloom, as I said, you know, we're the first company to commercialize this product. So I think everyone is extremely familiar with my old life of automotive and the ability to benchmark large companies, competitors, suppliers, multiple suppliers, you know, a 100-plus-year-old supply chain. You know, that we don't have that at Bloom. We are building the playbook. So there's a disadvantage in not having a big pool of competitors in an already existing supply chain, but I view it actually as a great advantage. You know, we don't have someone handing us a playbook, and we don't have history. So everything we do, we have to innovate. And partners, we have some of the most amazing partners in our supply chain. There are really smart companies out there that are willing to be on this journey with us. And they see the vision. They see that the energy market is growing. And they have to decide where they're going to put their resources. And they view that putting some of their resources with us and in the energy sector, these are bets that they're willing to take. And the power and electricity demand just continues to grow globally. So I feel it's a actual advantage to be able to build the supply chain versus having one that already exists. Innovation, speed, all the disruption that comes with that. It might be a little bit harder work, but the outcome, I believe, is very superior.
And wanted to double click a little bit on my manufacturing, because obviously there's a lot of Industry 4.0 initiatives all over the world. I was reading last week, World Economic Forum published their white paper on the global lighthouses, I think they call them, which are the best manufacturing plants in the world and all the different technologies that they use. I was curious if you in Bloom are, and I'm sure that you do operate with some of those, you know, technologies inside your manufacturing. So I was curious if you can share maybe, obviously not going into secrets, but some of the initiatives that you have done for Industry 4.0 from an Industry 4.0 perspective, and maybe some of the benefits and challenges that you got implementing it.
So we, like everyone else, are trying to figure out how to do work in a way that's repeatable, predictable, and stable. But the difference is we're also doing that while disrupting. So we have created the Bloom Production Way, which is today a third aerospace, a third automotive, a third semiconductor. So we are taking best practices from these fields as we bring people in, and there are people who've been with the company for a while who bring their expertise and their core competency. But on top of that, we have a lot of really smart people who are engaged, and we try new things all the time, working with our supply base, things people have read about. But just when you think about the product that we make, the innovation that is taken, much of what you see when you see the box, and when you see the box, you don't see the, what's inside the box. But when, you know, if you went to one of the places where a box is today, most people think about the technology. But we have a really, really innovative equipment team. We make all of our own equipment. We may use, you know, base platform pieces, but then we make the equipment and we write the software to build the processes. So I guess I'm kind of proud that I can't really talk about a lot of the detail of what we do because it is proprietary to the product. But we, you know, Industry 4.0 really is how Bloom makes the product today. And we do make sure that we, you know, we don't get complacent. We stay on top of new opportunities and new ideas like everyone else.
And also, I mean, now from the global scale, right? We have a couple of big tensions going on. So one is obviously the COVID-19 situation. Another one is the big geopolitical, let's say, tensions that exist in between several countries and several spheres of influence worldwide. How do you see that playing out from a manufacturing perspective? There's a lot of, you know, reshoring, decoupling discussions going on, more from a broader perspective of manufacturing in general, not necessarily about Bloom, but manufacturing in general. Like, how do you see the situation in the next coming years shaping up?
Yeah, so I may see reshoring in a different way than other people do. There are large chunks of work that would have existed in the United States in the 60s and 70s when I was coming of age in the 70s that were then outsourced to other countries. I don't know that those will come back. How I see it may be slightly different in that the innovations that we're seeing, telemedicine, grocery delivery, online schooling, these innovations are just going to fundamentally change how we live life. And then as they change how we live life, that will change manufacturing. So electronics, things that need to be better suited for a much more durable use. I probably use Zoom 10 times a year, you know, in the last 3 years, and now I use it 10 times a day. So it's, you know, hardening that product of this, you know, communication process and who makes the hardware and who writes the software and how do you deal with the bandwidth issues that are out there. Amazon on steroids. I mean, I see the world kind of full circle. I went from my grandmother having her milk delivered in a reusable container that someone brought to her house to going to the grocery store because, you know, nobody did that. Who wanted to deal with all the management of making the milk bottles and managing the milk bottles and returning the milk bottles and making sure the milk bottles were clean, to now people are getting milk delivered in milk bottles again and having them returned. So I see so much disruption in, so glass was important, then plastic was important. Now you see this return to glass. I see so many opportunities. You know, we live on a planet with limited resources. And so I see manufacturing really as being that catalyst to take the limited resources that we have available on the planet. And I also see manufacturing taking the things that we've already made and figuring out how do we repurpose things. Instead of making something new, how do you take something that's already made and turn it into something that's useful? So I see it less as a reshoring, not reshoring, and more as a how do you use what is here and how do we use the systems, all of these technological systems now that move products so much faster. And I think manufacturing will be very different. What we manufacture, how we manufacture. And it may, you know, I don't think the next generation will be about having the new shiny thing. I think they will be about how do you repurpose what has already been here and being able to manufacture or remanufacture existing materials into new materials. I see that as some of the breakthrough and something I believe we can do really well in the United States.
And I think that we badly need it. And all, on the other side, I was reading a couple of weeks ago, IKEA, the furniture seller, has opened a secondhand shop. They're testing this idea of selling secondhand in Sweden for now. Now, I don't know how it works out. There were some skeptics as well that were kind of asking, you really want to buy secondhand IKEA? But as an idea, I think that's that. Then the principle of sustainability, of circular economy, I think we need to accelerate that, as to your point, as you rightfully said, because we only have one planet, and you know, that's about it. So
you can only mine for so long, and we can go to other planets, right? There, but I really see, and I think I hadn't read about the IKEA secondhand shop, but I think as a concept, it's partially generational. You know, my grandmother reused aluminum foil and, never would have considered using a paper plate or a plastic fork. And if she did, she would have, obviously she wouldn't have washed a paper plate, but she would have definitely reused the plastic fork. And I think that whole concept, I read, that Gen Z has a lot in common with the greatest generation. And I think they're going to disrupt manufacturers that have to think differently about how it's not going to just be extracting and making, but it's going to be extracting and making and repurposing and making. I see it as an and. I see it as both.
And in terms of, I wanted to also ask you, in terms of skills, talent, we're also getting a question from Kumarish on this perspective. Like, what do you see that the industry, and specifically, let's talk about manufacturing, needs more of in the future, right? Is it automation skills? Is it, digital transformation? Or what type of skill sets are needed to push the industry forward in the next 3 to 5 years that maybe today are a little bit lacking?
Yeah, I would say there's the traditional skill gap. But if you really kind of name it, I call it technologist. It's welders, robotics technicians, analysts, people who can take the data that comes in, make the charts and graphs. They may not be able to necessarily make all the conclusions, but putting data together so that engineers don't have to do spreadsheets, and I see this kind of like technologist role, especially in manufacturing. And I've said this for many years. I've been in manufacturing since the late 80s, and the terms when I was growing up in the steel town, the 70s, were kind of unskilled labor, and skilled labor. I don't see very much unskilled labor opportunities. You need to understand data. You need to understand trends. You have to understand multiple jobs if you're in at least in the production lines that I have been, that I have managed. And then I think it's really a skilled technical person that doesn't have an engineering degree or a technical degree. Maybe they don't want to go to school, maybe they want to get a 2-year degree, not everybody wants to sit in a desk. And of course, I also view education is going to be disrupted post COVID. So maybe that'll make it easier, but there are a lot of really competent people with competent technical skills that don't necessarily have the moniker of engineer. And we would, any place I've worked, we'd hire those people all the time. So, and we end up doing the training. I did every company I've ever worked for, we've done the training ourselves. And I think in the end, that's okay for manufacturers to do the training. It'd be ideal if everyone came out of high school or trade school with all the skills, but really, if they have an open mind in today's world, and want to learn and have some technical competence. And then I would say on the flip side, if I had to do my life over and I have two kids myself, I'd be a material scientist. I think that is such, it gets back to this, whether you're extracting material from the earth or you're repurposing material that's already been extracted, how to make materials that are more functional, use less water, use less energy, use less, just use less, and maybe are repurposable in nature, that are lighter. So I think that's a really exciting field. And I'm actually speaking to a group of middle school students on Saturday. And when I talk to young girls, that's something I really encourage them to think about, you know, looking into to material science.
That's a great tip, especially for the younger folks that are listening to this. Wanted to also move to something that I know is dear to your heart and is also a big challenge. I mean, from where the industry sits, from where we sit, as I mean, our day job is actually headhunting and executive search, and there's a constant, let's say, uphill battle. If you're a female or a woman in manufacturing, it's actually, well, it's hard actually in general in supply chain. If we look at supply chain in general, but manufacturing in particular probably is the hardest of the chain. How was it for you? And you know, how did you navigate? Because I can assume it wasn't easy. I also read stories of you being pregnant and leading large production lines. And obviously, that's not easy. So maybe tell us a little bit about that.
So, yeah, so this could be a whole separate podcast. I mean, I have stories. Maybe they shouldn't be podcasted. Yeah, it has definitely been a challenge. And like my career, it's been a journey. And I would say, you know, when I started in manufacturing, women in manufacturing were expected to act and dress like men. And I never did either. I'm actually famous for keeping lip gloss in my back pocket when I was on the production floor. And for me as a woman, it was really important to send some subtle messages and some not so subtle messages to other women on the production floor to be themselves. And it has been a struggle, and nothing worth doing is easy. And I'd say the main challenge, and I assume the main skill that I have been able to master, is getting your voice heard. And often you will come up with an idea or you'll say something and someone sitting next to you will repeat it verbatim, and the conversation will start as if that was their idea when they had actually just repeated what you said. And my best comeback for that was always, well, thank you very much for repeating my idea. I'm glad you thought it was worthy of conversation. So it's subtle. It's not subtle. It's be yourself. You've got to fight to have your voice heard. And I don't know if it's easier today or not. In some ways, there are many things that are better than when I started in manufacturing. But I think some things are actually more difficult today. People are less apt to speak their truth. You know, I had men tell me, you know, I don't want to work for you because you're a woman. You know, you can actually deal with that, right? You know where that person's coming from. They've been very clear, and you can have a conversation around that. You can agree to disagree, and they can either come to respect you or they don't. So I do think that as the generations come through the workforce, the amount of resistance is not as strong, but, you know, it's been a journey. And I really, in the end, my hope is that I have blazed a trail and broken some glass for other women to follow. I've mentored and sponsored many women in my career. So I look forward to, just as the women before me have laid down a path, to doing the same for the next generations.
And we get this question, and I don't think I'm in any way positioned to speak about this, but I was actually asked to speak on how do we groom more female talent, and I was like, I really don't know, but yeah, I gave it my best shot. And anyways, one of the questions that came from there was from one female leader was, you know, but how do you even come up and say in a way that the management doesn't understand that you're coming across as negative or nagging? Or, I mean, I think there's a significant concern for women to even voice, right, and say, look, I mean, I'm going to come across as, you know, I'm a feminist, or, you know, so maybe let's
I'm a feminist.
Yeah. So what would you respond to that? Because I think you would know way better than, I mean, I actually didn't know what to reply to that. So I've not been put in that.
And I, even after as many years as I've been in the field, I do not claim to be an expert on all of this, but I do have a lot of experience. And I have been called many things in my life. And if somebody takes the time to call me a name, you know, I mean, they're paying attention, right? I mean, you have to really, you have to frame the discussion. I am a feminist. That word meant something very different when I assigned it to myself, you know, 40 years ago, 45 years ago. but it really means that I believe that women can be competent and women can succeed in the workplace and in a manufacturing world. And what I like about manufacturing, some days I don't like it so much, but you always know where you stand. You either made production or you didn't. You either had a good quality day or you didn't. It's very measurable. So I don't want to say it makes it easier because nothing's easier. It makes it less hard because you are able to measure and have data then to have a discussion. Are you going to be accused of being loud and pushy and, you know, all those things? Probably. But if that bothers you, you probably, you know, you should rethink manufacturing anyway, because it is a very, you know, you have to be have to have an overt, well, there are many people who are quietly effective, but in general, manufacturing people are more extroverted, more overt. And it doesn't, you know, and I come from a generation where, you know, you just were told to suck it up and have thick skin. I don't necessarily think that that's the most healthy way to live. And I think the new generations, you know, the generations following have much healthier lifestyles and healthier respect for each other in the workforce. So I don't think you should accept abuse, but you do have to take the feedback and filter what is real feedback and can help you and make you better, and feedback that just goes over your head.
Mm-hmm. And what would be some of your advice in terms of other manufacturing companies grooming and or helping or supporting? And you mentioned also, you know, the fact that you've been a mentor and a sponsor to many women, but just in general as a policy, and it is a man-dominated world as well, right? I mean, having men advocating for the cause is just equally important sometimes. But do you have some pieces of advice? You've seen some things work better than others in terms of grooming this female leadership?
Yeah, and I think to your point, yeah, it can't just be women advocating for other women. It needs to be people advocating for people who are the most competent. But I do always, you know, I do believe you have to have some focus on women, because if you don't, the women get lost. So in some cases, and there's some stories I have where I founded women's networks. We have the Bloom Women Leadership Initiative. You know, Ford had women in manufacturing. Nissan has a women's group. And some women are very uncomfortable. They're like, I don't want to go to that. I don't want to go to that because then I'm going to get labeled. And so I won't use which auto company, but I've only been at two. So you got a 50% chance of getting it right. So I had because I love to walk the floor. I love to get to know people. And I realize people aren't going to just walk up and talk to me, right? Once the best thing I ever do is when I first come into a factory, most people don't know who I am. They don't realize who I am. And I go out, sit in picnic tables and just kind of talk to people. And then later they're like, hey, I know who you are. I'm not talking to you anymore. So, or, you know, or, you know, I won't, they're like, but you get that first 100 days, you learn a culture pretty quickly. So I went down, sat at the picnic tables after I founded, not founded, but sponsored a women's initiative. And feedback got to me that some of the women were uncomfortable because their bosses were saying, oh, you're going to go to the hen club. Oh, you're going to go to the, you know, to the knitting circle. And to me, that's just people being uncomfortable. It's not necessarily, you always have to assume positive intent, right? So it's a production supervisor, whatever, maybe uncomfortable or superintendent. And so I would just go down and sit at the picnic table and say, hey, you know, it'd really be nice if X person could, you know, you could get them off the line for an hour, or if they could participate in this, I think it'd be really helpful. So, you know, it takes, I guess my point saying all that, it takes enormous engagement from leadership. There is no other word I can use other than leadership. You have to walk the talk. You cannot, you have to recognize that people are human. And it's a change, and they're going to be uncomfortable, and address that discomfort in a healthy way that they understand. And then you make lasting change. You can go in and break a lot of glass, and then you don't necessarily make lasting change. But if I was going to give any advice to manufacturers, accept that people are uncomfortable, accept that you have to do the work of getting the teams comfortable, and then go out and find some really good women they're out there. I could rattle off 100 names sitting here, and you will get better results. In the end, if you want to sell this, you will get better results. And there is so much research now that with data shows that diverse work teams have a better outcome. And in the competitive global world we're in, every manufacturer needs every advantage they can get.
No, that's some great points. We're getting some great comments of people that enjoy your stories, and we also got this question that I'm gonna throw at you, Susan. It's not from a diversity perspective, but Kumaresh is asking, if you were to go back in time 30 years when you started in manufacturing and change something to today, it's an interesting question, so I'll throw it at you. What would you change? Is there something that you would have hoped?
Well,
that
this is going to be a really boring answer. I would eat better. I mean, one thing, I used to drink a 6-pack of Diet Coke. I've always had a lot of energy, and I've always eaten out of vending machines. And, you know, now that I've moved to California and I actually eat healthy because it's just part of the culture here, I realized how much more energy I could have had, maybe how much more emotional intelligence I could have had if I was not living off Snickers bars and Diet Coke, but actually eating like a vegetable and some protein. So there's many things I do, but that's interestingly, as I think about it, that is definitely something that I would do. And I think I'd be a lot easier on myself. I'm very, very hard on myself. From, not that I'm a perfectionist, but I set very, very high expectations, and I don't cut myself a lot of slack. And when things didn't go well, you know, I never had to have a boss come say anything to me if something went wrong, because I would be more critical of myself than they could ever be. So I'd eat better, and I would be less harsh on myself.
And the final question for me, in terms of the younger audience that are listening and maybe they aspire to be an executive or a CEO or a C-level at some point in their careers, what would be one or two pieces of advice in terms of shaping their careers and planning, or, you know, what has been most work best for you when you look back and you take the lessons that you've learned throughout your career?
So I would say a couple of things. I would strongly encourage anyone to go into manufacturing. When you look at a volume of jobs, if you look at a company that's an industrial or technology or whatever you want to call it, the majority of the leadership positions in general, and particularly, you know, in automotive, are in manufacturing. So if you just are looking at a, you know, kind of a numbers opportunity, there are many more leadership roles in manufacturing than there are generally in other divisions. And you can do so many different things. So you can run plants, you can be an engineer, you can be in supply chain, you know, the breadth of opportunity in manufacturing. So one is, you know, kind of go where the pool of leadership opportunities are, if this is something that you aspire to, and then solve really hard problems. Everyone has really hard problems that needs to be solved, every company. And figure out, you know, in today's world, it's more team related. It was more functional when I started. It's much more enjoyable to be in teams, but, you know, get on those teams, you know, be the person that the leaders go to when they have really hard problems. Be, you know, when I think of something, and whose name pop, you know, when I've got a problem or a solution or a collaborative effort that needs to be managed, you know, who comes to mind? You know, be that person. And the way to be that person is taking on the tough responsibilities. I started my life over at 51. Not many people do that, but, you know, I went from basically, you know, a very stable industry. You know, you wouldn't think that today, but 7 years ago, automotive was still pretty predictable. And in general, it's still pretty predictable. There's an enormous amount of disruption going on, but, you know, people still drive pickup trucks in most parts of the world. And so I took a risk, right? But it was a calculated risk, right? Bloom was a known quantity. They had product in the field. They had amazing leadership. So you can move in one company and move around. If you're in one company, my advice is you should move around. And if you're okay bouncing from place to place, you should do that. But take calculated risks, not just crazy risks, but calculated risks. and always push yourself. In the end, I'm definitely a lifelong learner. You know, I grew up in a time when women could be secretaries, nurses, or teachers. The advantage of that was that all those things required education, and all those things require certification to maintain and keep up. So that whole lifelong learner concept really is ingrained, I would say, in the women of my generation. And my grandmother should have been a judge or a lawyer, and she didn't have access to secondary education due to her gender and her socioeconomic status. So she really imprinted on me to be a learner and a reader and to be curious. And I still do that today. And my house is surrounded with books and the, you know, the things you were talking about. You know, I've got to get on your, listen to your podcast more, because I didn't know about IKEA. You know, that one got past me, but I read all the time, and I never assume that I know everything. I assume that I know that I have experience, which is different than knowing everything. So learn.
There's some great gems. So Susan, with that, I want to thank you for all the great stories and case studies shared. And I think you have definitely inspired a lot of people today, and hopefully a lot of women to take on and you know, fight the battles that still need to be fought. It's a reality. And yeah, I just want to say big, big thanks. And it was a pleasure having you with us today.
Well, thank you. Thank you for hosting me. Yeah, fight the battles, but be yourself.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to go to www.elcottglobal.com and click the podcast button for all the show notes of the interview. Also, subscribe to our mailing list to get our latest updates first. If you're listening through a streaming platform like iTunes, Spotify, or Stitcher, we would appreciate a kind review. 5-star works best to keep us going and our production team happy. And of course, share it with your friends. I'm most active on LinkedIn, so do feel free to follow me. And if you have any suggestions on what to do and who to invite next, don't hesitate to drop me a note. And if you're looking to hire top executives in supply chain or transform your business, of course, contact us as well to find out how we can help.